Welcome to The Airwave, West Yorkshire Internal Medicine Teaching Collaborative Podcasts. In association with Airedale General Hospital and Bradford Royal Infirmary, a Chief Registrar Programme initiative. On today's podcast, I'm joined by Dr. Greenwood as we go through a couple of medical cases focusing on potassium management taken from ChatGPT. So hello everyone, welcome back to the Airwave Podcast. It's Mark, the faculty lead for the Airwave Podcast, and I'm joined today by Dr. Greenwood, who's becoming quite a regular partner on the podcast. Elliot, if you want to introduce yourself.
Hi, yeah, I'm Dr. Elliot Greenwood. I'm one of the IMT3s at Airedale General Hospital.
And say so this is your, I can't remember how many you've had now, about three or four times I've had you on. You're a more than welcome person, and I think the listeners enjoy having you on. So thank you again for joining us. And we decided that we'd do, I think it's probably the most preferred podcast that we've done, which is the podcast talking about cases, where we get a case from ChatGPT. I've got two for you today, with an underlying theme, something I've been talking with the juniors about quite a lot. We'll go through these cases, talk about them. I'll present them to you. I haven't told you what they are, so if you do make any faux pas, then it's entirely your ability that's shining through. And then we'll talk a little bit about the management strategies of them. They are cases that I've come across in the last few weeks. They're actually all relevant things that I've come across in my practice whilst on call. So there's some little interesting tidbits to go through and some management and practice points. So just two cases. Are you ready to go?
I'm ready when you are, Mark.
Cracking. Right, let's get going. So I'm going to start you off, and you'll have to apologize because this is ChatGPT. It's a bit Americanized. So when I say high school student, that's obviously a bit of an Americanism. But I'll talk to you about Sarah. Sarah's an 18-year-old high school student who struggles with her body image and has had weight concerns for the past few years. She describes herself as being heavily influenced by social media and has unrealistic beauty standards. She constantly feels pressured to be thin. Over the past few weeks, she's been feeling unwell, lethargic, tired, and generally not her normal self, and her weight has been declining. She's been seen by a general practitioner who notes her weight is continuing to fall, and she has a fear of gaining weight. She had some routine blood tests done with a general practitioner. She's been asked to come straight to the emergency department to receive treatment for these blood tests. Bit of a start for you. I suppose the first question is going to be, what's on the blood test that's brought her in? Is that the first question you'd like to know the answer to?
I mean, given your history of anorexia nervosa, which is exactly what you're kind of describing there, you're thinking maybe malnutrition and possible refeeding bloods, so electrolyte abnormalities. Usually GPs tend to get high potassiums, or in this case probably low potassiums or low, you know, electrolytes, and panic and send them straight to A&E to get them rechecked, don't they? So I guess, yeah, what's on the bloods, Mark?
So it's almost like I've led you into this case on purpose. So if I told you that her full blood count is unremarkable, no issues on a full blood count, it's her urea and electrolyte panel that has concerned the GP. She has a potassium of 1.8, a sodium of 139, a urea of 3, and a creatinine of 60. Is there any other bloods you'd like added on? I'll have to imagine them up because I've not written any more bloods down. So if you do want something, I'll have to come with it on the spot.
Well, I definitely want something like a bicarb. I'd want some basic observations and ECG as soon as possible and put her on some cardiac monitoring, if that's true. I think, so initially what you want to do is you want to do the basics well, don't you? So you'd assess her, get a bit of history, ask about like GI loss, diarrhea loss, you know, potassium, basically what potassium loss, diuretic abuse you'd be thinking about as well, something like loop diuretic, furosemide. I mean, sodium's okay. So you've got someone with potentially life-threatening hypokalemia. Urea's a bit on the low side, which makes you think maybe she's not eating as much. Creatinine's okay, so you don't think it's renal-induced in terms of, also, if it causes a metabolic acidosis due to renal thing, you get hyperkalemia, don't you? Not hypo. I'd probably want to know what her renal function is in terms of her eGFR, which obviously might be underestimated because of a lean body mass. Liver function tests would be useful. Her albumin's probably going to be through the floor. She's going to probably be hypoalbuminemic because she's not eating enough protein to make proteins. But yeah, first thing, ATP management, I'd want to get Lavabor access cannula into her, because I'm going to have to do aggressive potassium replacement, I think, in this lady. I'd probably want an ECG looking for hypokalemia changes. I'd want to get a blood gas on her to check for metabolic acidosis or any other problems that are going on there, lactate, anything that's correctable, what's a bicarb, just for a baseline. But yeah, definitely maybe move to resus for some cardiac telemetry.
So if I tell you that a bicarb is 18, the albumin is 22. Any other results you'd like to know? ALT, the rest of the liver panel's okay. There's no big issues there at all. Say if she's got a mild metabolic acidosis, pH is about 7.32.
Oh, is this going to be some weird renal tubular acidosis? I hope it isn't.
If I've seen it on call, it probably isn't, because I wouldn't have spotted it either. There's a part to the history, but when I tell you, you'll be like, oh, of course, that's what it is. So there's a bit of history digging that we have to do.
Okay. So, yeah, I think once I've got some potassium running and she's on telemetry and I've let ICU know about this very ridiculous thing and I'm waiting for them, I'll ask a few more questions about her. Has she had any diarrhea and vomiting or loss?
So she denies having any diarrhea or vomiting.
Are there any evidence, and this is something I recently asked and have seen, I can't remember the name of the actual sign, but unfortunately people who do cause them to make themselves sick, bulimia, you get sort of hardening of the knuckles because of the teeth. Is there any signs on her peripherally that suggest that she is making herself unwell or sick?
Do you mean Russell's sign?
You've just literally typed that in front of me.
I have just typed into Google, but you said it. I was like, I do remember that being a thing. Bulimia hands, it was called. No evidence of bulimia hands.
Okay. Does she take any medications?
Nope.
Does she buy any illegal medications?
Not that she's telling you.
Not that she's telling me. So we don't know if she's using diuretics, fine, or laxatives. Does she have any problems with her urine or bowels?
She denies any problems with urine or bowels whatsoever. She says that she's feeling entirely fine, beyond feeling a bit weak.
Okay, so fatigue, but no palpitations?
Nope.
No.
And now ECG, you've got plumb normal, a bit of U-wave formation, but really unexciting ECG.
With a potassium of 1.8?
Well, yeah, for the benefit of this story, it is.
Right, okay, so some U-waves, but the rest of the T-waves look fine.
But if it's where you've seen it and you've gone, I'll leave that for later.
Okay. I mean, I probably am going to still give her some IV potassium replacement, I think. I'll probably want to probably send off some refeeding bloods as well, some magnesium and phosphate. You mentioned earlier to add some more bloods on, but I think magnesium, obviously, if she's hypermagnesium, no matter what I do, that potassium's not going to come up, is it?
Well, that magnesium's less than 0.3, I think, is our record, as is the phosphate, less than 0.4.
So the phosphate's quite low. Magnesium, 0.4. The guidelines, depends on the trust as well, would say if it's less than 0.4, you could treat either way, depending on the severity of symptoms, and it's a clinical decision. I would probably give her IV magnesium replacement alongside the potassium.
She's got a lot of drips, hasn't she? She's got phosphate, she's got magnesium, she's got potassium. She's got them all, hasn't she?
Yeah, and like I said, I probably want to maybe move her to a place of safety, which would be probably level 2 care, given her electrolytes. She'll need cardiac monitoring and strict electrolyte replacement, won't she? It's fine. So she denies any drugs. Does she drink any alcohol?
No, she's teetotal. And her gamma GT and all the other bits you might look for are all normal as well.
Fine. And is she known to have any sort of previous history of mental health or eating disorders?
So she's got some history of depression, and there is some suggestion that she might have some personality disorders, but otherwise she lives a reasonably comfortable normal life.
Okay. Any recent drugs at all? If she'd been at parties, any illicit substances?
You're going on these drugs, aren't you?
Yeah, I am.
So it's almost like you know what's going to happen. No drugs. No, she denies. She says she is a completely normal person.
Okay. Well, my impression is severe hypokalemia, most likely secondary to malnutrition, given the phosphate, magnesium, everything else. And if we've got no GI losses and there's no history of any drugs that she declares, then I would treat her as such and make sure she's on cardiac monitoring while I give her a replacement, get baseline investigations. Would I send a urine ewes and ees? I don't think initially I would send a urine ewes and ees if her renal function's fine. You know, to look, see if it's renal loss, to check what sodium potassium is. I mean, sodium's fine, isn't it? And yep. On examination, normal examination, I'm guessing she looks a little bit thin.
She does indeed.
But anything else on examination, any sort of peripheral stigmata, any sort of syndromes or diseases?
There is no peripheral stigmata of GI disease, to give you the PACES language. She appears entirely normal. She's got a little bit of a generalized belly ache, but otherwise nothing to really write home about from an examination point of view. Blood pressure's a tad on the low side.
Okay.
Should I tell you what happens next? So you said you're admitting her. Admitting her, not sending her home. The IV potassium, IV magnesium. So replacing everything IV, giving her a full replacement. And she comes in to standard ward bed, and about 2-3 days later, everything's corrected. She's feeling significantly better, and she wants to go home. What do you think about that?
Okay, sorted, Mark. Let's move out.
Let's go home, yeah. Cracking off you go.
So I guess then this is where you think about the ethics thing. So if you had, from the history that you gave me initially in terms of the sort of introduction, you obviously have highlighted quite a lot of features suggestive of anorexia nervosa with, you know, probably life-threatening electrolyte abnormality. You'd probably maybe try and speak to her about mental health involvement. It depends really if she has capacity. So if she has capacity and declines it, there's not really much I can do. If she is accepting of that, then maybe I would want to explore that further. I don't think an acute hospital setting is actually where that is best managed. There are specialties and specialist centres that do manage that, and a referral to that would be maybe appropriate if she's accepting of it. If, however, it comes out that she's actually, I don't know, at risk to herself, everything's corrected now, so there isn't so much risk to herself, but if she is recurrent admission or, say, for instance, abusing diuretics and things and causing health harm to the point where she's at risk to her own life because of this, then that's when you might be thinking about mental health involvement and maybe the Mental Health Act.
Yeah, but so funny to say that. Mental health team come and see you. It takes a few days for them to come and see you, but you think, I need to get a mental health team to see you. So she sits on a ward, ends up being about 4 or 5 days. Whilst the mental health team come in, they get some additional information. So she's just sat there receiving some kind mental health support. But they say, no, it's okay, she can go back home. You've checked her UNEs a few times whilst that's been the case. No change. Potassium sat at 4. Everybody's happy. Electrolytes all back to normal. Mental health team say, nope, she's good. Send her on her way home. We'll pick some stuff up in the community. Happy?
What does the patient want? What is the capacity of the patient?
The patient's happy. The patient likes to go. And as walking out of the door, you're happy for her to go?
Yeah, I have to say I am, because, you know, you've got to think about the ethics of medicine, aren't you? You've got to respect patient autonomy. If that's how she chooses to live her life and there's no risk to herself or others at the minute, if I've offered her help and there's going to be community health, that's a safe plan. Mm. But, you know, at least she knows that there are people there that she can contact if she so wishes to. And I think that that is the most important thing, is that you have a safe plan in place for when she goes home. It's not like we're discharging her into the streets with nothing at all. She's going to get community mental health input and someone to monitor her weight. The GP will get a discharge letter, and we could ask the GP to say, could you touch base this lady in 2 weeks' time to check her weight and electrolytes? You know, that might be reasonable. You know, I think you have to respect patient autonomy, do good, do no harm, and treat everyone the same. So if it was absolutely anyone else who had capacity and wanted to be self-discharged and there was no acute medical need to keep them in, I would let them go.
Okay, so you let her go. 3 days later, you're on call again, and she's come back in. Potassium again is 1.8. Magnesium this time is about 0.4. Phosphates held steady this time, phosphates normal. But she's back in hospital. Potassium's low again. The GP she represented said, I feel weak again since having left hospital. Potassium's back in its boots again. What are you thinking this time?
I mean, she's definitely taking something, isn't it? Your potassium doesn't drop that acutely in 3 days unless you're doing something, either losing it through GI loss. But then if she's vomiting lots, you wouldn't get an acidosis per se, would you? You'd get a hyperchloremic, hypokalemic alkalosis, wouldn't you?
Would you? Well, so is there any other tests you'd now like to order now that you're suspicious that something is going on?
Well, interestingly, a very similar case has happened to me. And
you may well be the same patient, so let's be careful.
Now, knowing what I now know now, I think you need to take a really delicate social and psychosocial history, don't you? And you need to very delicately challenge the patient on their health beliefs and what they are taking per se, because what we're suspecting is possibly some laxative abuse or diuretic abuse. Now, you can do a urine screen for both, but it will take some time to come back. You can do urinary use and ease to see actually what is coming out in terms of urine, because, you know, your body is very good at keeping homeostasis. So your body's natural response to low sodium and low potassium is to stop excreting sodium and potassium. So if you have excess solutes of sodium and potassium in your urine, either the kidneys aren't working properly or you're taking something to promote renal loss.
And how would you work that out?
You would do a urinary use and ease.
And then what would you do with it?
I'd try and interpret it.
So this is quite an interesting one, because this is very much what came upon call. It was a patient who previously, there was a suggestion of a diagnosis, but it wasn't entirely clear cut. So actually what we did was we did something called the transtubular potassium gradient, which is something I've ended up talking about with a few people since then as a way of proving. So what would you expect in the case of, you'd mentioned laxative abuse, how would her potassium in the urine have changed?
Well, it'd be increased, wasn't it? So it's a loop diuretic, works in the loop of Henle, so it affects the...
Diuretic, not laxative. So if it was a laxative...
Oh, laxative?
Yeah.
A laxative wouldn't affect her urine, would it? Because it acts on the bowel.
Yeah. So what would her urine potassium be relative to her osmolites and her serum potassium?
I would assume normal.
Well, it'd be low, I suppose, wouldn't it? Because you think she's holding on to the potassium.
Yeah. Kidneys will be trying to, as I said, homeostasis, trying to reabsorb the potassium. True.
But if she was diuretic abuse, which you're about to say,
yes,
she would be, potassium of urine would be higher, sodium of urine would be higher, and it would all look a little bit odd, wouldn't it, from a biochemical perspective. So actually when we tested her urine potassium gradient comes back low with a history of laxative abuse suggested. All fits the bill, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you do about that now?
So this is really tricky, because I guess it's a form of self-harm, but it also depends on the sort of psychosocial involvement and the patient's health beliefs and things. And given the complexity of the case, I don't think it's a single person input. I think you need support from both mental health team, maybe an eating disorders unit. You know, this isn't something that's going to be retrained overnight. You know, this person clearly is doing this for a reason and feels that it's an important reason to do it, i.e. for whatever it is, either OCD or EUPD or something, like they are believing by doing this, you know, there's a reason for them to do it. So having to teach someone that it's not okay and for them to relearn different behaviours can be sometimes quite difficult and not an easy fix.
It's about approaching that conversation in the MDT way, isn't it? Having all that support she requires. And it's psychosocial. It's all the different bits of the coin that you want to pick up. And in terms of discharging her, you're going to do the same thing?
Once again, it becomes really difficult. I think if she isn't well enough and doesn't trigger, you know, a Section 2 of the Mental Health Act, if she's been seen by a psych and they don't feel that that's appropriate, and you have, you know, people working with her in eating disorder in the community, as I said, the hospital is probably not the best place to try and manage this, given the acute complexity of and the lack of privacy that a hospital kind of gives you. And also, like I said, capacity, it's really difficult, isn't it? So you think about Capacity Act versus the Mental Health Act, and I think you have to have an individual approach. I don't think you can particularly say in this case one way or the other, and it depends on the situation at the time and the severity of the risk that I would probably speak to my colleagues about at the time.
It's complex, isn't it? Complex patients. And that's going to be a theme to the next case as well. And as with that, I'll bridge it on to the next case. But it's worth talking about. I talked about the transtubular potassium gradient being quite a nice way out of complex situations with patients when... And often patients who are abusing some medication will not always confess to that, which is understandable because that's part of the process for them. So that mechanism of support, but also getting to the diagnosis sometimes can be obstructed by mental health problems, and being aware of that and unpicking things through and needing that extra support from blood tests or, as you mentioned, urine tests to help us identify that patient may be taking something is a really key step. So, next case. You ready to go?
Yeah, ready.
What I have now, I have a 58-year-old woman past medical history of Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And don't worry, that's the last you're going to hear of it.
Excellent.
Because we don't talk about Hashimoto's thyroiditis as medical registrars. Has presented with fatigue, nausea and vomiting, and loss of appetite. Is initially presented to the emergency department with a chest infection, pneumonia. Has a high curb score and high oxygen requirement and vasopressor requirements. Is therefore taken to the intensive care unit for treatment. Is de-escalated 2 to 3 days later down the line. And has now been sat on a ward for about 10 days. Antibiotics have now finished. Renal function is again just starting to slowly work its way off. Creatinine has been up in the 400-500 range. Settled down to about 100. It's now starting to creep back up. Patient's feeling fatigued, lethargic, generally unwell. Now, over the course of the last few days, the sodium has been falling, which has been concerning the medical team. Overnight, the medical SHO is called. The potassium has suddenly come back at 6.1. The ECG is unequivocal, difficult to really unpick, is treated as being hyperkalemic, undergoes insulin dextrose, undergoes calcium carbonate, undergoes NEBS. Potassium raises itself to 6.3. What are you thinking?
What's the blood pressure?
Blood pressure is 100 over 60. Chest is nice and clear.
Any history of long-term steroids?
Yeah. Going to make this case rather boring if you jump straight to the answer. Yes, thyroiditis is maintained on a dose of 20 milligrams of PRED, which was restarted when the patient returned back from the intensive care unit.
And is that her maintenance dose?
That is her maintenance dose.
Okay.
She did temporarily receive her IV hydrocortisone from the intensive care team.
That's maybe why she got better on intensive care and has now gone back downwards. So effectively, if you've got someone with, the reason I asked immediately about blood pressure is about the pattern of hyponatremia and hyperkalemia. So hyponatremia, complex, but most importantly is you assess fluid status.
We weren't going to talk about that, but we decided that hyponatremia is not worth doing a podcast on because we would get it wrong and someone would complain.
Oh, no, I won't get this wrong, I promise.
No, but if we did the whole topic of hyponatremia, we'd make some mistake somewhere. But this is one tiny bit of hyponatremia, and I think we can get this bit right.
Great, okay.
I'm going to try our best.
So effectively, fluid status. So you want to know her fluid status, basically, because that will teach you initially what to do in the acute setting. So if they're dry, it's mainly due to fluid loss and, you know, renal loss, whatever. So you need to rehydrate them. If their uvulins got overloaded, then it's going to be fluid restriction in the main symptoms. But that helps you narrow down the clause. So if they're uvolemic and hyponatremic, it's going to be something like SAIDH, adrenal insufficiency, or, you know, thyroid disease. If it's overloaded,
is it not the Hashimoto's? Mention the Hashimoto's.
You mentioned the Hashimoto's.
I have mentioned that. Do you not reckon it's the Hashimoto's thyroiditis?
Well, we're going to get into the pattern. So,
and then we're not getting into the Hashimoto's.
No, if it's overloaded, I hate endocrine. So if we, I didn't say that. So if we go into like overload, then it's, you know, chronic liver disease, chronic kidney disease, and congestive cardiac failure. Basically, you fluid's in the wrong place because you're not making a protein, your kidneys aren't doing it, or your heart's not pumping it. So uvolemic or overload, you fluid restrict. Now, with that though, if you see a certain pattern and a history such as hyponatremic, hyperkalemic, and hypotension, the first thing you should really think about is adrenal insufficiency and adrenal crisis. So, you know, non-specific abdominal pain, you're vomiting, your history of long-term steroids, because everyone always forgets about sick-day rules. So sick-day rules with steroids, obviously, if you're unwell, you need to double your steroid dose for as long as you are unwell and then gradually wean those steroids back. So it looks like this lady's got unwell with a community-acquired pneumonia. She has been getting some hydrocortisone on an ICU. She's given vasopressors. And then the steroids has been covering for adrenal crisis. She's been stepped down to the ward. She's gone back into adrenal crisis. She's now hypotensive, hypokalemic, and hyperkalemic. And the way I remember this is spironolactone. So spironolactone basically knocks out aldosterone, which gives you this sort of adrenal insufficiency. So all the side effects of spironolactone is adrenal insufficiency, adrenal crisis.
It's funny enough, she's also on spironolactone.
Well, that needs to stop.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, so the first thing you'd want to do is your basics. So you know, do your fluid assessment, send off your serum osmolality, send off your, you know, paired urine osmolality as well. And then you might want to do things like your thyroid function tests again, because as I said, thyroid function tests can cause a bit of hyponatremia, can do some weird things to potassium sometimes. And then you'd want to make sure to give her some hydrocortisone, because the risk versus benefit of giving maybe some hydrocortisone versus the risk of giving hydrocortisone, maybe some insomnia and some paranoia. But if it's adrenal crisis, then the benefit outweighs the risk a lot. So I would probably give her a stat dose of IV 100 milligrams hydrocortisone, see if there's a response there. I might start her on adrenal crisis sort of management, which is probably 50 to 100 milligrams of hydrocortisone QDS IV, and then you can always step her down to maybe, you know, her pred dose at 40 milligrams doublet for a bit, and then wean it down slowly would be my initial thing. But and it will take a bit of time for those blood results to come back in terms of the serum osmolality. Your main concern is the potassium, which you would treat anyway, which you've done with the sort of salbutamol NEBS and everything else, and hopefully as you give her the steroids, the electrolyte abnormalities and the blood pressure will correct itself.
Sounds like a clear plan to my mind. But is there any other tests you could do to help you unpick? So you mentioned you think it's Addison's crisis on the basis of the hypernatremia, hypokalemia, hypotension. There is some vague abdominal pain. You're treating on a basis, but you think that's the most likely diagnosis based on the, I suppose, all the events
around. I think on the history, yeah. So it's everything, isn't it? So she's on long-term steroids for Hashimoto's. Did you mention she has Hashimoto's?
I did mention she has Hashimoto's.
So she's on long-term steroids for that. That puts her in a risk category. She's recently had an acute insult infection, which is obviously going to increase her stress and demand on her body. But, you know, this is why we do the basics well, isn't it? This is why you still send off things like your triglycerides. If you think about pseudohypernatremia, it wouldn't really fit with the pattern. You might then do thyroid function tests to make sure it's not like to do with the thyroid. You want to do your fluid status and assessment. You want to check for other, you know, problems in terms of using these in the kidneys. Is the kidneys working properly? She's recently had a, you know, an AKI, quite severe AKI, which looks like it's corrected now. He said creatinine came from 600 down to 100.
If I told you the creatinine's starting to knit back up a little bit.
But that could be pre-renal, couldn't it? If she's hypotensive, could be pre-renal AKI. Because obviously you'd still manage that as any you would in your AKI bundle, which is pre-renal, renal and post-renal. So you'd still get a catheter in her, you'd monitor urine output, you might give her a bit of IV fluids and hydration slowly. You don't want her sodium to come up too quickly. And then you'd probably make sure that you were looking at things like her nephrotoxic drugs, such as spironolactone, you'd stop that. Mm-hmm. You may stop anything else that's going to cause her to be hyperkalemic, like ramipril, depending if she's on any other sort of antihypertensives that are going to cause her to be hypotensive and hyperkalemic. And that's probably what I would look at. I'd look probably at medications, her, and then have that kind of plan in place.
So if I told you that the TTKG can come up again here, the transtumor potassium gradient. So what would you expect it to show in this case? So we've mentioned that she's likely got some degree of aldosterone deficiency now because she's got adrenal axis deficiency. Yeah. What would you expect her urine? You mentioned the urine electrolyte panel. How can that be useful here?
Yeah, so I guess what I'm saying is it might work then like aldosterone, isn't it? So aldosterone... spironolactone on aldosterone. So spironolactone knocks out aldosterone, which obviously aldosterone causes vasoconstriction, reabsorption of sodium, and you reabsorb sodium, so you reabsorb water, that increases your blood pressure, but you lose potassium. That's normally how aldosterone works on the RAS pathway, or the renin-angiotensin pathway. If you give spironolactone, it knocks out that, which is why you get low blood pressure, low sodium, high potassium. So actually she's adrenal insufficient. She's not producing that aldosterone. I might suspect that actually she's going to have hypernatremia because she's losing it in her urine. She might have low potassium in her urine because she's retaining potassium. And then that's why she is hypotensive as well. So I might suspect that she's going to have low potassium in her urine, high potassium in her blood, and low sodium in her blood, but high sodium in her urine.
So all of which, when you put that together, her transtumor potassium gradient is going to be low because she's not excreting the potassium, not because she's got excess potassium she could excrete, but because she can't put it into the urine because of lack of aldosterone, which is a key component to the ability of the body to put potassium into the urine. And exactly that comes back to the urine potassium comes back at 2, which is very, very low. And the transtubular potassium gradient is very low, telling us that the person's not putting any potassium into the urine. Give the hydrocortisone what you'd expect. You'd expect that to get better, I suppose, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And it does. So one of the slightly rarer causes of hyperkalemia is patients with Addison's. Actually, I think, although it's rare, certainly pre-renal causes probably outweigh the majority of the AKI that leads to hyperkalemic problems.
Yeah.
There's a subset of patients that present with Addison's as hyperkalemic. And you mentioned that pattern, which I think is kind of how most of us see it. But you do get those patterns in the, not so much the pre-renal patients, because you expect their sodiums to not drop off as much, but certainly the intrinsic renal failure.
They're more your metabolic acidotic patients, aren't they? And that's what happens in hand in hand. So you get this metabolic acidosis, you get hydrogen ions everywhere. Hydrogen ions need to be then put into cells because a positive ion is going into a cell. Potassium, which is a positive ion, comes out of the cell because potassium is intracellularly, isn't it? So, you know, that's why people who are in, trovascular accidents, rhabdomyolysis, they get hyperkalemia because obviously you get leakage of potassium or burns as well. So, What you end up getting is the hydrogen ions moving into the cell and the potassium moving out. So that's why when you get a metabolic acidosis, one of the most common things with that is hyperkalemia.
Mm. So in summary, get this patient on the steroids, get the patient on IV fluids. What else are you going to do for? You mentioned about increasing the steroids up temporarily. How long for?
So that's a difficult one, isn't it? Like I said, I'd probably in the acute situation, given her situation, I'd probably put an IV hydrocortisone and then wean it back. Some people might say just double a pred and hold your nerve. I don't think, as long as you are giving more steroids, I don't know if there's a wrong or right answer there, but I might over-treat and then wean her down, start her on a double steroid dose and then wean it down 5 milligrams a week and see how we get to. I'd probably consult the endocrine team as well, because obviously adrenal crisis in this someone, she's going to be well known to them for Hashimoto's, isn't she? So
yeah, we're not mentioning the Hashimoto's, remember?
No, but she's obviously known to the endocrine team if she's going
to
be
on hormone steroids.
Yeah, exactly. And they'll probably want to know about the adrenal crisis, because obviously that's going to be something that's going to have to be monitored, and she's going to have, you know, maybe potential wristband and things like that in terms of double steroid dose. She's going to have some education about that.
Exactly. Any other thoughts about that case? Anything else that irks you or worries you? Or would you be happy that the treatment of the hydrocortisone, where would you repeat the blood? So you mentioned that potassium's come back. You've done your assessment. You've given some steroids. When are you repeating that next blood test?
What was the potassium? 6.3?
I think it was 6.3. Future me will say if it's not.
And was there ECG changes?
There were no ECG changes. If I'm wrong, I'm going to have to correct that because I can't remember. That long ago.
So I guess 6.3 with no ECG changes, I might hold my nerve and then repeat them in maybe a couple of hours. I'd probably do something like a blood gas and get it off that. I wouldn't maybe send a formal. Well, no, I probably would send a formal. I'd probably send a formal, but I'll get a blood gas because I could get the results in 10 minutes and I can act on that. Whereas obviously the E's and E's might take an hour to come back. So and then if obviously I do an ECG at the time, if there's ECG changes, potassium's not better or sodium's going worse, then obviously I need to have a think about what I'm going to do at that point.
What would be the thing you'd be thinking of?
What, in terms of the things have got worse?
Yeah. Where are you going next?
Depends what she needs. So if she needs to go back to HCG for BP management and electrolyte replacement and things, then we could do that. But I'd give the steroids a bit of time. I'd treat the hyperkalemia as I would normally with, you know, fixed rate insulin and dextrose. Over 15 minutes, I'd be on NEBS if needed. But I think I'd probably hold my nerves as long as she remained well.
Yeah. Yeah, seems fair enough. And I told you potassium gets better. Then we don't have to worry about this patient. She gets better. And then the next question is about Hashimoto's thyroiditis, and none of us know the answer. So we don't have to worry too much about that. But in terms of managing potassium, is that something you're happy with as a medical registrar?
I don't know. People might listen to this talk and think Ellie doesn't have a clue.
My attitude tends to be, I mean, the patient I suppose I most worry about these days, I don't get so upset about hyperkalemia, but I get a bit more twitchy about hypokalemia than I used to. I've seen a few bad cases.
I think what I struggle with, what I would hate, is when you get something like Lidl or Barta, where you have like potassium abnormalities with a renal tubular acidosis. I can never really remember the four types. I always have to look it up. That's when you start seeing weird stuff like, metabolic acidosis, low bicarb with low or high BP with potassium derangement. You're like, what is going on here?
Those you've got your cons and things like that.
Those are the ones that I personally, you know, always struggle with. They're always on part two of MRCP questions, though, aren't they?
And we've done our part two now, so we don't have to worry about them. But I suppose that's some of it, is if you constantly becoming across a biochemical abnormality in a certain patient, you're going to change your index of suspicion. And these patients don't tend to arrive acutely unwell.
No, so they're well known about. They usually present quite early. And I've actually seen two or three of these patients in my whole career now, and they usually come in for GP as check the potassium and it's low, and then they come in for IV replacement, and they're usually very well versed in it.
Mm, no, exactly. But hyperkalemia, I mean, one thing I always say to people, you know, one message I always try to get across is when it comes to hyperkalemia treatment, your treatment does not end when you've given the IV calcium and the insulin dextrose. But actually, hyperkalemia is quite an interesting challenge as a medic, because you get the opportunity to unpick a scenario. And as you mentioned, you go through your, is this patient congested? Are they third spacing a load of fluid? Are they hypovolemic? Is there an intrinsic renal problem? There's actually some really interesting medicine to do with hyperkalemic patients. So I actually find those patients easier in a way.
There is one that we forgot to mention, and that's hemolysis sample. So if you have someone who's really difficult, you've had the tonic on for a really long time, and you take a really difficult sample, that will give you an artificial hyperkalemia.
So what do you do about that? If we're, me and you are on call together and you've done a VBG. No, let's say I've done the VBG and I was doing under ultrasound. So tourniquet was on for about 15 minutes as I was burying around for a vein, and sample comes back.
You need to get better if you've
done it. Well, no, you're telling me to get better, but if the potassium comes back at 7.5 on a venous gas, but a patient's entirely well, then we were doing it to look for some abdominal pain.
Like I said, I'd repeat the sample. So if you have something that's so erroneous that it can't be true and isn't in keeping with the trend or how they are clinically, I would just send a repeat sample. I'd try and get another gas and send off a formal use-and-ease as well. Usually on the formal use-and-ease, they'd say hemolyzed sample, please interpret with caution.
And for your ECG, I talked about it on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, but what are the ECG findings you're looking for? You've talked about hyperkalemic ECGs, what are the main things you're looking for? Because we talked about some of the things like tented T waves, they can be quite hard to unpick, can't they?
Yeah, it's all tented T waves. You know, that's the main one, isn't it? So you want it everywhere, not just in like one or two leads, because some people see a bit of high takeoff and they're always a bit pointy, but they're like proper triangle shaped.
Pinching. I always describe it, I think I described it a couple of weeks ago as being a pinching of the T wave. It's not a slightly high takeoff.
Sometimes you get the high FT takeoff, don't you? And it's a bit rounded at the top, but it's like proper point.
Point. Yeah, yeah. But no, so anything else about hyperkalemic ECG? So T waves is kind of the most common early sign. And to be fair, I think we probably overtreat them in the first place. But hyperkalemic ECG, anything else you think of?
U waves, you get a flattening of the T waves, don't you? And U waves and hypokalemia.
Yeah.
You get, I'm trying to remember now which one it is. If it's...
Should I put you out of your misery?
Wait, no. Do you get widening of the QRS? And
Which one?
Hyperkalemia?
And hyperkalemia, yeah.
And do you get torsades de points? That's the one you're worried about, isn't it?
Torsades de points? Say points or points? I'm a much more... Yeah. I thought poire sounds more exciting.
I'll just say torsades and people.
Torsades, okay.
Spinning on the point, isn't it?
Torsades is hypo, isn't it? Hypokalemia.
Oh, now I'm going to have to ask you that. What do you think?
Well, so the other ones I've got, so Brash syndrome is something I talk about a lot. So proceeding into bradyarrhythmia. And to be fair, as a med reg, it's quite an exciting one. You get someone who becomes hyperkalemic and suddenly has a heart rate of 20. And as I'm sure you know, Elliot, when these patients become bradycardic, they can get very exciting very quickly.
Yeah.
We won't talk about that one. And then asystole is a common sign that's talked about. So, yeah, that's pretty bad. Don't want to have that. Development of a sine wave appearance.
Oh, yeah. I've seen.
It's all starting to fit now.
Weirdly, this is true. I thought that hyperkalemia always kind of causes more of a tachycardia. And what I've learned clinically, it can actually cause anything. I saw a lady once in ED resourcing complete heart block, and she had a potassium of 9.
So I talk about it. I think, I don't know if I've talked about it on the podcast recently, it's Brash syndrome. I talked about it a couple of weeks ago, and that's the development of bradyarrhythmia with hyperkalemia, particularly in pre-renal states, that leads to a consistent cycling of hypoperfusion in the kidney that drives further hyperkalemia that then sets the cycle off of ongoing shock. And those patients are probably the sickest patients you can look after, because if they go into complete heart block, it's far too late. Our cardiac output falls, they're buggered.
She actually weirdly was well. She had a heart rate of about 38 and her ECG was wacky. It was wacky. We moved her to resus and started treatment, and she actually bounced back quite well, actually, but quite quickly.
Did you put a DNR in?
No.
You're a changed man.
I am.
Need to stop having on this podcast. Otherwise, you're going to lose your flow with the respect forms.
I would argue that I try my best to reverse the reversibility. You know, things that are reversible, I will reverse, Mark.
That's very good to hear. So is there anything else we should talk about? So we talked about hypokalemia and hyperkalemia in a couple of different cases. Is there anything else you think is relevant we should tell to our budding listeners?
No, I think that basically neatly calls it a day, doesn't it, really? I mean, we've covered quite a lot in there, and I think the main point of this is your transtubular potassium gradient.
That's all I wanted to talk about. It's interesting, though, because there's certain blood tests and certain urine tests as you progress through your career. So I talk about FeNO a lot more than I used to, and FE urea and all these different types of tests. There's lots of crazy physiological calculators that can really help you. And particularly that patient who was the Addison's one we talked about, it wasn't quite clear because the steroids had been on recently and the patient did not feel particularly unwell. In all likelihood, the cortisol state was below where it should have been. So actually, this was more of a subacute presentation. So there was some vague abdominal pain, but there was also a bit of constipation. Blood pressure had been low the whole admission. We weren't quite sure if the patient was perhaps just a bit dry. And those are the patients that could be really hard to unpick. And she was more difficult. But actually, the trial of steroids was the right thing. But the urine electrolytes can give you that early indication. Because if you're not putting potassium into your urine and you're hyperkalemic, something is not right down the line. Some part of your body is not working correctly. So I think it's useful to think about, because outside of being doctors that follow guidelines, which is often what you are when you're a junior doctor, thinking about the physiological cause of an abnormality is really important. And actually, the reason someone's become hyperkalemic is intriguing. And unpicking that makes you a better doctor rather than just following a guideline that says, give fluids, see what happens. It's why we became doctors, Dr. Greenwood.
I think it's pattern recognition to simplify it down.
Well, that as well. Good pattern recognition. But yeah, no, thank you very much for joining me on today's talk. I think it's been a pleasure as always. And
thank you very much, Dr. Johnson.
Well, and then two cases to discuss, and I think they've been very interesting and dynamic cases. And we're hoping to have a talk very soon between me, you, and Dr. Mahmood about the high specialty training interviews, how they went, and a bit of a debrief. So that probably look to be our next episode if we're able to sit down and do that as a group. But otherwise, it's been a pleasure to have you on. Thank you very much for your time as always.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much, everyone. Take care.
Thank you for listening to The Airwave. We hope you enjoyed our podcast and learned something new. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing to our podcast on your favourite platform and look out for our content on YouTube.